Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
I've always had this kind of like a filter. So being able to filter out what criticism I want to take and what criticism I don't, and just knowing that your voice will come through if you let it. Because for me, forcing something has never made me feel good. Like a painting that I know what the painting is going to look like before I start it, it never comes out as like a, I want to say successful painting, but a painting that I feel good about. So I've really just been like one step at a time, you know, following this, like this kind of inner voice that's like, paint this, or, you know, just a feeling of like, I want to make a composition that's like this or that. And then looking back and being able to connect the dots of what I've made, it's a little bit like dream work, you know, where you start to see these symbols and you can decode it later. But I could not project what this body of work was going to say. I had to kind of make it and then look back and it tells me what it is. It's a little mystical to say that, but that's how I've been making work. That's my MO.
I'm delighted to welcome Emily Wiener to the podcast today. Emily is a painter living and working in Nashville, Tennessee. Combining ceramics and oil paintings, her works configure icons, geometries, and material motifs, which have been revived, reshaped, and recoded over time. Emily's work as an artist and curator have received press in the New York Times, the New Yorker, the BBC, New American Paintings, the Brooklyn Rail, among many others. She is a winner of the Fall 2022 Hopper Prize and a 2022 and 2023 nominee for the Joan Mitchell Fellowship. Emily is currently represented by the Red Arrow Gallery in Nashville, Tennessee, and she has quite an extension exhibition record. I'm so happy to welcome Emily to this conversation today to hear more about her work and her life as an artist parent. Emily, feels like it's been a long time coming, but also nice to meet you. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's really an honor to be here and to talk to you about these two converging aspects of my life.
Yes, I love when someone feels really jazzed up about the conversation. I definitely have interviewed a few people who are like, I'm not really sure if I want to talk about this, but I guess you convinced me somehow.
Well, that's, I think, why I'm jazzed about it, because it's very new territory for me to try to even synthesize these two aspects of my life in some kind of comprehensive way. So, I mean, that's a tall order, but.
Okay. Well, so much more to say before we kind of dive right into that. Why don't you tell me about being an artist? I'm always curious to know if it was kind of the path that you saw for yourself from an early age, you know, if art was a part of your childhood or if you happened upon it later down the road.
I think it's always been the thing for me in a way, like, you know, when you're a kid and you have to, your teacher asks you to draw a picture of what you want to be when you grow up. I think that was an artist, but I never knew what that entailed really. So, it was, art was the thing that made sense for me. It was the thing that came easy to me. And I think it also was like the safe harbor for me, you know, that I could get into a state that felt safe and, you know, just like a happy place. Mm-hmm. So that has been a constant since I was really little.
Where did you grow up?
So I was born in Brooklyn, and my parents left Brooklyn and moved to New Jersey, about 45 minutes out of the city.
Okay.
So it was a little suburban bubble off of one of the highways. Mm-hmm. And we had, you know, a house. I had my own bedroom. And I remember there was a like a foyer that my mom turned into like my drawing room. So I had like pictures all over the walls and I could like collect them there. So that's probably one of the earliest memories I have of like feeling as an artist.
I love that your art, you know, and I think kids are always takes up space in some form in a home, maybe whether that is as small as being put up on the fridge or like actually hanging it on the walls. But I think carving out a little studio almost is pretty rare for, you know, like a kid to have. So I love that your mom and your
parents. She did do that. I mean, that's pretty amazing. I hadn't thought about that in a long time.
Yeah. Well, why don't you describe what your work looks like for us? I always like to, you know, kind of as we get deeper into the conversation, I think it's nice for people to have a visual kind of in their brain of what your work is and what it looks like. Curious about your process. You're primarily a painter, but I know there's some, you know, lots involved in that. So can you share about your work?
Yeah, I am really like a painter. Like the material has always been something that is, I just love. I love paint. And even, I don't know, you know, in graduate school, I tried to do other things, but I really was always coming back to paint. So oil paint is my primary medium. And my paintings, they have... I would say it's like pretty graphic forms and bold colors, but the imagery is both, you know, I take a lot of representational images and I recombine them in kind of non sequitur ways often. So my paintings can look really different, like in a show, like, you know, one painting can be of a rabbit and one painting is a landscape and one painting is of a, you know, a ancient Greek vase. Mm-hmm. So it's really eclectic, but I've been told that there is some consistency in something aesthetically that comes through.
And that I think part of the reason that it took me a while to realize who you were, I think, is for that reason, because when I was living in Tennessee, you know, I would see your work in like group shows, but it might be like one painting or like somebody I knew like shared, you know, your work on Instagram. And I was like, wait, that's Emily. Oh, yes. You know, just kind of, yes. I'm not sure I know who this Emily Weiner is. Like, I don't know.
I think it's because I've never really been able to I've never been one to like be pigeonholed as one thing. And I don't really want a signature style necessarily, like that's so recognizable, because I don't know, it feels limiting in a way. And my sources and my references and all of these kind of artists that have come before that I really love, it's so eclectic. So I think my subject matter is very eclectic, but maybe the consistency is in like the way that the paint is applied. Like it's very, like there's a touch that it's like a kind of a thick way of painting, but it's overall a smooth surface. So it's not impasto, but it's also not like a lot of transparency or washed down paint. And then there's a lot of symmetry in my painting. And then a lot of these kind of symbols that recur over and over. So I think once you see enough of my work, and this is, I do this myself, because sometimes I'm painting and I don't understand why I'm painting a certain subject. But once I get further along and I put them next to other paintings, it makes sense. Like, kind of in this Jungian way of, there's like this recycling of, meaning that comes through in different forms.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think now that I've known your work for 5 or 6 years, like that consistency is so apparent. I'm curious, you know, if you could just talk a little bit about, I feel like that idea of developing a strong visual language or like a consistent visual voice or style is like a very art school kind of thing, you know, like as artists, it's like, how do I be an artist? Well, the number one thing people say is like, figure out your style or your voice, you know, as an artist. And I'm not presenting this question to say that you don't have that, of course, but just curious about, it seems like you have maybe taken that framework and pushed against it a little bit, or said like, I don't need to keep myself in a certain box. Like I want to be an artist who is more eclectic, who has more, you know, visual variety. I'm curious about that journey a little bit. Like, did you get pushed back or?
You know, I think the problem is that, you know, it takes longer for someone to understand the work. And for me, I didn't have enough work for it to be cohesive. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you have to build up a body of work. And I've really built up the work in the last, I'd say like 3 years, I've made the majority of the work that I've made in my whole career. So, but for me, I've always had this kind of like a filter. So being able to filter out what criticism, you know, I want to take and what criticism I don't. And just knowing that knowing that your voice will come through if you let it. Because for me, forcing something has never made me feel good. Like a painting that I know what the painting is going to look like before I start it, it never comes out as like I want to say successful painting, but a painting that I feel good about. So I've really just been like one step at a time, you know, following this, like this kind of inner voice that's like, paint this, or, you know, just a feeling of like, I want to make a composition that's like this or that. And then looking back and being able to connect the dots of what I've made, it's a little bit like dream work, you know, where you start to see these symbols and you can decode it later. But I could not project what this body of work was going to say. I had to kind of make it and then look back and it tells me what it is. It's a little mystical to say that, but that's how I've been making work. That's right now. That's my MO.
I love that. I feel like maybe you have a strong relationship with like your own trust and confidence and, you know, like you kind of said that you've always leaned on your own filter, like internal filter. Do you know where that has come from? Like, was that like part of the way you were raised, or was there a specific like mentor that kind of gave you that freedom to trust yourself? Cause you know, I feel like that is counterintuitive a little bit to, I think, a lot of younger artists' stories, you know, like we're so much more kind of, it feels more like a struggle to trust ourselves versus just to kind of be told what the art world wants us to do or what our professors want.
I know. Well, I think with everything else in life, I'm really self-conscious. Like I'm self-conscious about, you know, how I socialize. I'm self-conscious about my writing. I'm self-conscious about, you know, appearances, all of those things that are, I mean, I think is really natural, but I don't know, for this one thing, it's less of a, what other people think. And it's more of like, this is my, I don't know. It's like my survival strategy. It's like, I can't fake it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that. I feel like I'm the opposite. Like I'm like, I don't know. I know how to like do other things in the world, but being an artist, that's like what I'm always second guessing, you know?
Yeah. So. Maybe it's because it took me so long to actually make money as an artist. So nobody was looking at my work. I mean, my friends were, and I was running artist friend spaces and I had a lot of colleagues, but it wasn't like there was any commercial success with the work. I had day jobs. I kind of had faith that I could do anything else. Like I could, it was a struggle, you know, and I didn't have a lot of money, but I knew that I could support myself. So the artwork was the one thing where I had total freedom. So nobody was telling me what to do. So So yeah, I'm lucky in that way that I haven't, nobody was looking at me, and I have had really no success until very recently.
Yes. I think so many artists, you know, all we want is that success, that we forget that the freedom that comes without the, like, specifically the monetarily tied success is sometimes a bigger gift than the the success, you know?
Yeah, I know.
Emily, I want to hear you talk a little bit more about the symbolism in your work. You know, you have connected it to, like, art history and kind of some of these things that have come before, like archetypes. I'm curious how you land on imagery that you do seem to kind of paint over and over, like hands and moons and curtains and rabbits, right? I know some of it is intuition, but also I know there's a lot of, like, reference and depth there. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, so first of all, I went to college. I studied not an art school. So I went to Barnard College in New York City. It's part of Columbia University. And I majored in art history because there was not a visual art major. You could kind of focus on visual art. So I was very art history heavy in school. Okay. And so I think seeing so much work was just, you know, it kind of was like embossed in my brain, you know? Mm-hmm. And then after school, I worked as a writer. So I saw more and more work, and I never thought that art history degree would be like, you know, would have a monetary return, but it happened to. And so I went deeper and deeper into, like, you know, contemporary art and art history. So I think those, there's so much there that is like reference material that's just kind of floating around. But I've always been very confused about how the world works, you know, like, especially how other people navigate the world and have this, seem to have it figured out or understand what one is supposed to do, how somebody's supposed to act, what is normal. And so I think my paintings were ways of kind of decoding the world around me. The image of the curtain, I think, is like really about, like, lifting the veil behind, you know, lifting the veil of how we experience the world or how we're socialized to see the world versus what's the bigger picture, what's beyond the facade. Mm-hmm. So that comes up over and over. And then there's also the symbolism. A lot of the archetypes come through as, like, the image of a clown, the image of Harlequin, the image of a musical instrument, the image of a rabbit, which is like kind of a puppet for somebody else. They're all archetypes of someone playing different roles in society, or, you know, it's kind of, so those came a little bit later. And actually, after I had my son, Noah, I was working, and I think after having a kid, I realized, like, how many different roles I was playing in my life. So, like, at work, I was, you know, a curator and an assistant. Like, I really felt like a magician's assistant at work. Mm-hmm. Like, the white rabbit was, I started painting it, and then I realized what it was after I painted it. I was like, this is so obvious. Mm-hmm. You know, this kind of stand-in as, like, a prop for somebody else's tricks. The white rabbit kind of, I think, was like a version of me at my day job. Mm. But it has a different meaning too. It's like the white rabbit is something that Alice follows to go deeper into the rabbit hole, right?
Right.
And then, like, the clown was also, you know, the kind of sad, the fool, the person that is playing, like, kind of the goofy role, but traditionally, like, he's someone who has a lot of, you know, like, sadness or is hurt. Mm-hmm. And I really liked that clown character because, you know, the deeper I went, again, I just started painting it, and it scared me. I was like, this is, I'm not supposed to make clown paintings. That is like what you do not do as an artist. Right. I mean, cats are great. Like if I was painting cats, that would be cool. But like a clown, it was scary. And when I first showed Red Arrow this clown paint, it was a big, like, it was kind of like the shirt front of a Pierrot character from the 1800s. I was like, guys, what do you think? Like, this is terrifying me, but I like it. And so of course I had to go deeper. Like, what does a clown represent? How far back does it go in history as a stock character?
Hmm.
And of course it goes back to antiquity, but I also found that, you know, in the 1800s, 1900s, often it was like a way to be political when you weren't allowed to be political.
Hmm.
So in Russia, or even like thinking about Marcel Marceau, who was the mime in France, he was, mm-hmm. while he was famous as a mime, he was also like smuggling, you know, children out of occupied France to save them from Nazis. So there's also a rich history of this kind of clown character in Jewish theater, Yiddish theater. So of course, again, deeper into the rabbit hole, like these symbols occur, and I relate them to my own personal life, but also these layers in history and in culture.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I'm curious too, you know, being somebody who's had this journey with kind of studying painting and then moving towards more like mixed media and textile work. Mm. I know one of the transformations that your work has had is including ceramics and thinking about the frame, and, you know, kind of hand building these components that go with your paintings, mm-hmm. you know, or become a part of the painting. Would you want to talk a little bit about that process and journey?
Yeah.
And how new is that? That's just the last couple years?
Yeah.
Or?
So I started making wood frames for my paintings for a show at Soloway Gallery in Brooklyn. And I think that was 2015.
Okay.
Like I had access to a wood shop, so I was building the panels and building frames. And I was just starting to think about like design elements or elements that were considered like less important than painting, like capital P painting.
Mm-hmm.
And also like, you know, what the hierarchy of kind of materials and what those spoke to about, you know, in terms of who uses those materials. Or I think it was a little bit, now thinking back, it's like a little bit of a feminist gesture. Like I was annoyed when, you know, it seemed like something decorative or something design oriented was considered lesser than like mm-hmm. kind of, you know, male genius kind of painting, like, right. But when I was starting to go to museums and I noticed like a Mondrian painting where Mondrian was making his frames, and I just thought it was so cool. It was just like mm-hmm. very simple, and he painted them white himself. So I just started making them from wood. And I loved it. I was painting them. I was gilding them. I was like putting texture on them. Things that I couldn't do on the painting, I could do on the frame.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked out really well. Like, and I realized that they were kind of like another way, like the stage that I could show. There's like, okay, here is this is demarcating the space of suspended disbelief.
Mm.
You know, it's like another way to say like, painting can hold all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, this frame holds all of this. You know, mm-hmm. it's like another, I think I love the rabbit hole. Like I love double, like layering and going yes. deeper and deeper. So the ceramics was an idea I had after that first show at Soloway. I collaborated with the same artists and they're Icelandic. And we were doing a museum show in Iceland about a year and a half later. That was kind of an extension of that first show we did together where I had made those wood frames. And it was in a museum where we had a fourth ghost collaborator who is an Icelandic stained glass artist.
Wow.
She's very well known in Iceland. And I wanted to kind of have a material connection with her. And she did a lot of sculpture and you know, the glass is like something that's like heated and vitrified. And And I was like, I want to make these out of ceramics. So, so I learned how to do that from two really amazing ceramic artists. I did a residency at Oxbow for a week.
Okay.
With Matthew McConnell and Linda Lopez, and they showed me how to do these frames, which are, they would never have been successful, but there was like a very specific way that I learned to make them. And so I made them for the show, and I've been kind of elaborating on them since.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I love the work that has, you know, kind of an intentional framing. I think it just adds so much.
Yeah. And I love ceramics that are like, it's a way that you can kind of control without control.
Yeah.
Because there's so much that happens in the kiln that you know, it's surprising, especially in like a high fire kiln with glazes. I'd never know what's going to come out. So that's exciting for me.
Yeah. And I think I feel like I'm seeing a lot of painters who are kind of thinking about ceramics and painting and kind of those relationships, much as I'm seeing, you know, there's like a big kind of contemporary fabric and textile movement and combination of that and painting. And it's like also a lot of women artists that I see who are painters are pulling ceramics like into their practices. You know, Amy Chan, I just had a conversation with Madeline Donahue. Like there's just a lot of folks who are kind of, I don't know. I love the like contemporary embrace of like cross-disciplinary practices that, you know, are so rich right now.
I think it also speaks to this moment we're in where women have been allowed into the conversation as, you know, serious artists. And I think it's a certain defiance of using these materials, which have traditionally been like women's work, the textiles and the ceramics, and in a way, bringing those up to the level of any other material, which was traditionally hailed as the fine art material. So that's exactly what, you know, why ceramics appeal to me so much. I mean, not just because they're such an amazing ancient form of art making, but also because I want to use something that, you know, is a little bit defiant in the face of what art history has prescribed for us.
Yeah. And I love what you said when you started that conversation about kind of the validity of the decorative, right? Or the beautiful. I feel like that is a big part of this conversation too. And, you know, making, like I just saw Madeline Donahue made like a Ninja Turtle toothbrush holder.
Amazing.
And it's like brilliant, but also I'm like, a Ninja Turtle toothbrush holder, like this is amazing, you know?
Well, you know, I was just, this was like an idea that I had yesterday, so I don't even know if it's going to fully come through as like a, like, just like as like understandable, but I think that there was in throughout like modern, you know, modernism, there's this idea that sentimentality is bad.
Yeah.
And that like the soft, you know, it's like everything is so hard-edged and everything's so conceptual. And I'm starting to think like, what is wrong with like the more human connection, the sentimentality? I don't know. I want to make sentimental paintings because that's not necessarily what they are. They're not about my own life, but I think, you know, it's okay to make work that you want to have an emotional appeal.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think that came through a lot. I went to college and I'm so grateful. I mean, I love him as a, you know, a writer and a scholar, but Benjamin Buklow, who is a, like the big Gerhard Richter kind of writer, was my art history professor. And he really was against this idea of sentimentality and for this kind of idea of, I think, you know, he kind of perpetuated this idea that painting was like an end game, kind of like, how can you paint after Pollock has painted, you know, like that it was this game of like, how do you close the doors on this way of making? But I think throughout, you know, my time.
Like valuing kind of invention over.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. Like it always has to be new or different or. I mean, that's such a tough one too. I think it kind of goes into this idea of, even the internet and social media and the way that we see images all the time over and over and over. And, you know, that's something I've been thinking about a lot is like how no idea is new, right?
Mm-hmm.
At this point. And, right. And where do our ideas end and where do they begin? And if that is, you know, kind of a goal, right? A path is to like create the new thing.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that leave us in this age where everything yes. that you think is a new thing that you just pulled out of your butt, like you turn around and put it on the internet and somebody's like, oh, that looks like XYZ, you know?
Yes. Well, but also, I mean, to reframe it, it's like, what's, yes, there's always going to be the new thing. Mm-hmm. There's always going to be the new iPhone, the new way to charge the iPhone, the new way of like connecting to your device or whatever. But is like, for me, it's not about conquering and making the next thing and like a very kind of like, how do we build on top of this thing to make it better and better and better? But it's like, how do we understand the matrix? How do we yes. see through? And understanding that it's not just that conqueror at the top. That's not the game. Like the mm-hmm. game is to see through and see, like kind of understand how the component parts fit together.
Yeah, understanding the connections, right? Yeah. And allowing that richer conversation to mm-hmm. be a part yes. of the work that's made rather than these like siloed.
Yes. And these silos of knowledge that one can only understand through this channel of like knowing what came before.
Yes.
I do understand that kind of work, but it took me a very long time and it was like a lot of confusion and just, you know, spending time with art history and going to museums. But I also really want to make work that someone can understand intuitively without having that art historical background, like mm-hmm. walk up to a painting and have a visceral reaction because there are these geometries that have, you know, resonate in our yeah. primordial brains, like in a Jungian way, like a power yep. structure that's like a triangle.
Mm-hmm. Yes, same. And even, you know, I feel like I take that a step further in my work, and it's why I included, you know, textiles is to have that exact, oh, that reminds me of my grandmother or exactly. my, you know, like yeah. Mm-hmm. How very feminist of us.
I know. Well, also that the individual is important, you know, like that encounter with artwork, if it can remind you that, you know, it's not about making you feel small and
yes.
Making you feel like not smart enough.
Right.
Making you feel like a, you know, a human connection to something. I think.
Yeah. You know, I want my work to make people feel known, you know, mm-hmm. to feel yeah. comforted or to feel cared for, like
yeah I think that's what the world needs.
Yes,
a little mothering.
Yes.
On this episode of the Artist Mother Podcast, I wanted to share something I've created to help support your career and studio practice in 2024, the Thriving Artist Map. The Thriving Artist Map is a year-long guide created to help you plan out your art practice, stay focused on your goals, and grow your career. Included inside are 52 weekly studio planning spreads, quarterly goal-setting sheets, art business worksheets, social media newsletter and marketing planning pages, a fully dated calendar, and, you guessed it, so much more. The Thriving Artist Map is the planning tool I've truly always wanted to exist in the world to support my art career. And I absolutely can't wait. I can't wait to dig in to 2024, start planning, and start using the map. You can grab your own copy if you head to www.artistmotherpodcast.com/map, M-A-P, to learn more and purchase yours. They do take a couple weeks to ship, so I would really encourage you to snag one soon so you have it in time for New Year's planning. Once again, you can buy your Thriving Artist Map and get organized for 2024 at artistmotherpodcast.com/map.
Okay, before we get into artist parent stuff, I want to hear just a little bit about your curatorial practice, because I know that's a big part of your work. And I'm not, you know, I'm not sure about the timeline, but I kind of gather that maybe you did a lot of curating before you really pushed into your own practice. Is that?
Well, it came out of my own practice because, you know, I went to grad school, which was like so amazing because, you know, I went to grad school about 5 years after I graduated from undergrad.
Okay.
And 5 years, I was a little lost, you know, because I was working full time in New York City and, you know, kind of exhausted and trying to make work as much as I could, but it felt a little directionless. And after grad school, it was like these 2 years where you get all this attention on your work and it's like, you make all these incredible connections and suddenly you're spit out. And again, like nobody's, you know, looking at the work if it's not, you know, picked up right away. So my friend Sharona Eliasef and I, she was a classmate of mine. We started doing this apartment show at my apartment. I had this really great apartment in Brooklyn Heights that I got through a friend of a friend. You know, I had two roommates. One was a roommate who was Cuban and a roommate who was Brazilian. And they were always out, you know, and they were cool with me putting on these big shows in our apartment. And we did this for like, I don't know, from 2013 to 2016. And we started just inviting everybody we knew from grad school at first. And then more people, Sharona went to Skowhegan and there were a bunch of those friends and then friends of friends. And so it was a way that we built community in the city. Mm. And I met so many people through doing that. And it wasn't a very conceptual, you know, we would have these very generic themes like love. What else was it? Ice storm. It was like in the middle of the winter. There was like a storm predicted for that week, you know? And it was just so fun and rewarding. And then from there, my great friend Annette, who also worked a day job that was like mine, and we would have lunch in the city. She was already running an artist-run space in Brooklyn called Soloway. Okay. And she started the space in 2010 after she graduated from Bard with like three other classmates. And it was actually like a ground floor space with, you know, that was like a proper space. We had hours. And I joined on as a, you know, as a co-director.
Okay.
And so we would put on shows like monthly. So it became like from doing like a little apartment show, it became something slightly more official.
Yeah.
And I did that through the time that, you know, I had my son and left New York City.
Okay.
And then when I came to Nashville, it just so happened that I had these curatorial experiences under my belt. So I was hired as a curator at Vanderbilt.
Mm-hmm.
They have a permanent collection of objects. And so when I needed a day job. So that was the day job that I was able to find here in Nashville. So it supported me financially as a curator for a couple years when I moved here.
Awesome.
So yeah, it's like something I fell into, you know, I was doing for myself, but then it became a path that kind of took over my life.
Yeah. Well, how do you feel like those curatorial experiences have kind of helped you as an artist, other than the obvious one of just making connections with people, right? Which is one of the things I would say this podcast has given me, right? It's kind of given me this just outlet to make connections with people beyond just my own work.
Yeah. I think it gave me, just like writing, it gave me like a deeper understanding, like more empathy for other artists and to value kind of that exchange, like the correspondences between artworks.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, working in a kind of museum quality collection, I had these like physical experiences, like direct connections with these art objects. That was more than just going to a museum. You know, I was like having to care for and pick up like ancient artifacts and and deciding how they're displayed. And that was like a real learning curve. But there also was like a, I don't know, there was like a deep connection through time, because suddenly these objects, which, you know, were made like a couple thousand years ago, or even like hundreds of years ago, there were some Renaissance paintings there. For a brief amount of time, like those were under my care. And that was, I don't know, it was like very humbling. But it also, I think that crept into my dreams a little bit, because that imagery, like, you know, I think you start to think more deeply about it when you have to mother it, like when you're under, you know, again, it's like a transformative experience to be responsible for something like that.
Absolutely. Okay. So tell me why you moved to Nashville. Like was that a career move? Was that, you know, just overwhelmed with New York and getting out
of my gosh. Yeah.
High cost of living. What was that about?
That was like an extreme, like snap decision based on overwhelming need.
Okay.
New York, like I'd lived in New York for 20 years. Everybody I knew was in New York or the Northeast. We had a child. We were not fully prepared for what that meant.
Yeah.
You know, we were still living in this apartment.
Yeah.
Which I had had before I met him, with a roommate, because it's expensive in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a kid, and we suddenly, I wasn't working because I had been adjuncting in different schools, and I didn't have like, you know, paid time off or maternity leave or anything. So we were suddenly super broke.
Mm.
And my son was like, to say the least, he was not an easy baby. Like,
okay.
You know, some babies, I don't know, maybe there's no such thing as an easy baby, but you know, I was not prepared for what this entailed. And like 6 months in, I was like, just so physically and emotionally depleted that I remember there was a day where, you know, my son and I, it was so hot in our apartment.
Mm.
And my landlord told me that I could not install like a bigger air conditioner because it would blow the fuse of this old building, like it would start a fire. And so we were smothering in the city. And I was like, all right, I'm going to take him to the Brooklyn Museum, because at least there's air conditioning there.
Right.
Dragged him on. My son would not get in a stroller. He would not get in a car seat. So I had to walk everywhere or take subways everywhere with him. So I got on the subway. It was like 90 plus degrees. And he was all red. His face was red. And someone yelled at me on the subway. They were,
no,
can't take this child out in this heat. You know, as kind of like, have something to say, you know? So I felt already pretty bad and like a bad mother. And then I walked into the Brooklyn Museum and, you know, it was nice and cool. We finally made it. And my son projectile vomited all over the place. And I remember this guard came over to me and she was so kind. I mean, she could see I was like physically, I was like shaking, you know, like exhausted. And she helped to get someone to help clean it up. And I was like, I called my husband from the museum and he was working in Midtown. And I was like, Michael, we're moving home. He's from Tennessee.
Okay.
Nashville. So I didn't really know much about Nashville. I've been here a couple times for like Christmas. And but I knew we couldn't stay anymore. It was the city had broken up with me. It kicked me out. And I was like, you know what? I don't know what we're going to do. I don't know how we're going to do it. But if we have to, we'll move to he has a family farm about an hour and a half out of Nashville.
Okay.
I was like, if we have to, we'll just bring a whole pot of our stuff, like plunk it down at the family farm and live with your parents, you know?
Oh my gosh. What did he say? Was he like, I'm sold. Let's do it.
Yeah. He was like, okay, let's do it.
Wow.
And he got in a cab and picked us up at the museum. And then we had 6 more months in New York City until our lease ran up. And we left on December 1st. It was my son's first birthday.
Aww.
So we made it 1 year in New York with the kid and we got out. And wow. I remember feeling this, like, you know, this life that I never thought I would leave, but out of necessity, it just I was able to just cut it. Like, it just floated away. And that was my old, you know, that was
I think that's called survival, right? You were basically like, I can't.
Yeah.
You know, it's just too much to manage.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to do what we can do to survive at this phase of our life, you know?
It was pretty extreme.
Extreme, but like so relatable. I mean, I've talked to quite a few artists from New York, and I think basically and I'm certainly stereotyping here, but you have to have a lot of money, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, like you move away, basically.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not sure what the alternative is. Like,
yeah, you know. I have a few friends who, if they bought real estate early on, or they were able to afford real estate in New York City for whatever reason, then they could stay and figure it out.
Yeah.
But we did it, and we were renting, and my family had moved out of, you know, out of New York City and out of the air. Even my sister had moved upstate. So I really had no support anymore. It had gone from, I can't imagine leaving this place, to I can't imagine how I'm going to survive anymore in this place. It was like a paradigm shift because, you know, I mean, I'm sure people have said this on your podcast like every time, but you never know exactly what you're getting into.
Yeah.
When you become a parent, it's just so, it's so different.
Yeah. There's no way. And everybody's, you don't know how you're going to be as a parent. You don't know how your kid's going to be. Like, you can read all the books and it could be useless knowledge, right? Because, you know.
Yes. All of those books were useless knowledge to me.
Yes. It's so much. Emily, you mentioned earlier in our conversation that the last 3 years of your career have kind of been when you've made the most work, or like, you know, your best work kind of.
Yeah.
But you have a 5-year-old, right? So
yes.
Tell me, you know, I guess 4 years ago you moved to Nashville, right? Your son was one. So you navigated moving to a new place, but then also it seems like this transition has been good to you as an artist, at least has provided you with space, whether mentally, physically, you know, to really make some big pushes in your practice. I'm curious, you know, about that. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, it's so surprising because
I'm sure you thought it was going to
it was over.
End you. Like, I can't ever be a real artist now because I'm leaving New York.
Yes. Like, I was just getting some traction in New York City when he was born. And in the beginning, it was really disheartening when I moved here.
Yeah.
But the other side of it was like, I had all of this space, like, you know, the conveniences of not living in New York City, like being able to go to a Target. Like the first time we went to a Target, I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing.
And you went to a Target with your car.
It was incredible. Yeah. And we had all this space. And so I think it was just, I don't know, it was kind of this mental shift that happened. I was working full time, but on the weekends, my husband's parents are quite young. They had him his mom had him when she was like just turned 20.
Okay.
So his mother's only like 16 years older than me.
Okay.
So she was, and Noah's the first grandchild. So she was ready. She didn't, she was so excited. And we would just drop him off on the weekends at the farm. And we were able to work all weekend. My husband's a musician.
Okay.
And, you know, and we were both artists with a day job. So I think, you know, after you have a kid, the priorities switch to like, you know, where should I be like going out and, you know, seek outward. And it became really inward, like very focused in the studio. And I just used a room of our house for a studio. First we were renting and then we bought a house. which to us was affordable compared to New York City.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I was working for a while at Vanderbilt, and it became clear to me that that wasn't sustainable either. Like there, you know, academia was different at that school. It's like kind of an older Southern institution. And I was not really, I don't know. I didn't totally understand it. And I didn't feel like I fit in, at least in the department where I was working, which was the art history department. And so I got to a point where my husband had a job, you know, like a decent job with health insurance. And I had just had a show. My first solo show was right before I turned 40.
Okay.
And it was in a shed in Atlanta at a space called White Space.
Okay.
And it was just, you know, and that was enough. Those paintings all sold.
Wow.
There were like 6 or 7 paintings, and it just gave me a little cushion and a little bravery to quit the day job. And it was terrifying. You know, I didn't know what was going to happen. I was still teaching a little bit at Watkins College at Belmont University.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a little income that was like, I knew was going to come in, but it really was like a plunge, you know? But then, you know, it's crazy to have that much time all of a sudden. My son was in daycare. We have him at a little community Montessori. So yeah, I was like ready, you know, I just was ready to make work. And then I think it just happened. You know, opportunities started coming to me. I got a grant. There's a Tennessee grant from TriStar Arts that I got. It was like a $5,000 grant, and I proposed an exhibition and I brought it to Red Arrow Gallery, which is a gallery in Nashville that I just loved because it reminded me of Soloway Gallery in Brooklyn, where it was really cultivating a community here. It was, it's a commercial space and they're viable commercially, but it felt like, you know, the reason they were here was to build this network of artists. And to me, that's so precious, like not just having like an international success, but just having, you know, other people in your direct environment.
Yeah.
So I proposed this show to them with the grant money and said, hey, why don't we do this group show? Would you be into hosting it? And that started our relationship. I kind of approached them.
Awesome.
And then, you know, we had this group show and the sales were good at that show. And so it's just been kind of like one show to the next, you know, I'm just suddenly like, this is the first semester that I'm not teaching. Mm-hmm. I'm not working a day job.
So you're not adjuncting anymore.
I'm on pause. Like I'm an advisor for the MFA program, but it's like, you know, 5 meetings the whole fall. So pretty much no other
amazing
job, you know, situation except for my studio. I'm 42. So this has always been what I'd wanted, but I couldn't figure out how to put the pieces together until now.
Well, and I love that, you know, you guys kind of took this big risk out of survival, but it has really reaped a lot of rewards for you. Can you talk a little bit about your experience of like kind of rebuilding your community? I think as artists, you know, I'm sure you have a lot of your New York folks still a text away, you know, and a plane ride away. And that connection, I'm sure, is also still so great for your career and, you know, just for your network. But I think cities like Nashville can be a challenge because I know in particular Nashville, there's like this big influx of new people who move. And so there's like this very transient community type people, but then there's also people who like have lived there their whole lives, you know, and it creates kind of this weird dynamic of like, how do you navigate sort of, and I feel that way in Fort Wayne, Indiana, less that there is a lot of the big transient people, but more of like,
people love it here. And so if they grew up here, they live here their whole lives. And it's hard to like be a new person in that space, you know?
Yeah.
And I think being an artist, it's just hard to build community anyway, because we require so much like alone time, you know, we're doing all these things by ourselves. But then of course you're a parent on top of that. So, you know, I'm just curious about kind of the constructs of your community. Like, has parenting been a way to like make friends, or has it really been more your artist network?
Well, I mean, since becoming a mother, I have so many less friends. I mean, they're all still friends, but I was so social before being a mother. And then suddenly I was alone, you know, in New York. It was really hard because I was pretty much the first one to have a kid of my circle of friends, which is interesting because I was 36. So I wasn't that young, but people who had children had moved out. And my sister had also moved out of the city. So I was especially alone. So the community, people were a text away, but a lot of the time they were like in Israel or in Korea or had moved from New York City. So moving to Nashville, my husband had gone to Vanderbilt and Belmont for undergrad. So he had some friends here. And
his family. So you weren't starting from scratch, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah, he had his family. And then people reached out to me. For me, actually, moving to Nashville was a lot more welcoming than, say, if one were to move to New York City, which is like you're really starting over and nobody knows who you are. They don't really care who you are.
Yeah.
But it was nice. Like Jody Hayes reached out to me, you know, because I moved here and my friend Amy Pleasant had sent out an email to everybody that she knew and said, "Hey, Emily's moving here. Like, get together with her or meet her or holler at her."
She's one to know.
She's incredible. And Jody did a studio visit. Fatty Turner came over for a visit. People reached out.
Yeah.
And I appreciated that so much. It was like really validating and really wonderful. And it was like so kind. And I think it was also out of necessity in a small art scene here. It's really exciting when they're new. There's like, you know, new artists to connect with. So, it was for us, you know, having kind of being at a place that was like very desperate. Nashville was a little bit of a paradise. And I think, you know, some people might get angry at me for saying that, you know, because I think people moving in and gentrifying Nashville is definitely, you know, it's problematic for a lot of people who have been here, but but my experience, my personal experience was really a positive one.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, Emily, why don't you tell me a little bit about kind of what you're working on now? I'm curious if you are working towards a new show. I know you mentioned before we kind of pushed record that you're kid is in full-time kindergarten now. So just kind of like what is like a day in your life looking like right now? And, you know, what are you working on? What are you spending your time in the studio doing?
So I'm working towards two shows now.
Okay.
And I just want to back up for a second because like, if there's anybody that needs to hear that, I had clearly like a very difficult transition to motherhood. You know, it was hard for me. I wasn't prepared in so many ways, you know, and it was, everything was so difficult. But now that my son is in kindergarten, it's like, I feel like the light has, like the clouds have started to part.
Yes.
Like, there's a certain ease now of living where he has an independence where, you know, I don't have to be so, he's not taking up all of my mental space anymore. And I kind of, my career, I feel like, took a real detour, but now is on a track that I kind of couldn't have imagined before having a kid. And I owe that to Noah, because for being so difficult, he really pushed me to be somewhere that I would not have been. So he's the reason, you know?
That's so amazing.
Yeah. And he's not an easy kid. Like, mm-hmm. I love him. He's brilliant, but mm-hmm. he's not an easygoing child. He's really difficult. And mm-hmm. it's because he's smart and strong-willed. And so when mm-hmm. I'm with him, I am not working. Like, there is mm-hmm. there has never been a time where Noah was in my studio and I was getting work done. Never. Mm. So like the picture I sent you, it's totally posed. Like it happened once and I was like, Michael, come over here, get pictures. It's kind of like, I remember this picture of Ruth Ozawa, the sculptor with kids in her studio. That's totally posed. Like that was not happening. That's fake.
Yeah.
So yeah, for Noah, it's like, just to know that is not my daily routine.
Yeah.
So anyway, yes, he's back. He's in full-time school. And he loves school. He has his own life that has nothing to do with me. Mm. And so I really feel like, yeah, back on track. So two shows coming up. One is a solo show at Red Arrow Gallery in February.
Okay.
So it's really my first solo show since that shed space, which was teeny tiny. And now this show is big. So I'm working a little bigger. I have some canvases coming in that are up to like 60 inches.
Ooh.
So that's a big scale shift for me. And then I have a show in May, a solo show in Mexico City that I'm hoping will manifest, and it should be a big deal. but so it's like now I have the opposite problem of like waking up in the middle of the night and wondering how I'm going to get it all done. Whereas like, you know, 5 years ago, I was waking up in the middle of the night and thinking like, will I ever have the chance to paint again?
Yeah, I think motherhood in particular, one of the biggest lessons I've learned, which also like goes along with being an artist, but just that things change so fast, you know, like you can... Like you said, like one season, feel like you have nothing going on, like no deadlines. And then the next season, it's like you have to figure out how to do all of these things, like all at the same time. And, you know, same with your kids, like you're like one season, you feel like you got it down and things are smooth. And then all of a sudden, it's like everything is chaos. I don't know why everything is chaos, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love what you said about, you know, just kind of normalizing the challenge of those transitions. And yeah, just like that it doesn't always look the way that, you know, or it isn't always what it seems, you know, like we might seem like we've got it in the bag and it's this fluid, we're on the living room making art together and... Yeah, I just that, you know, I think for more people actually, they don't want their kids involved in their art practice. Mm-hmm. And like, that is great, you know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Emily, I feel like I could talk to you for another hour. Our time is like coming to a close. I'm like, I have so many other things I want to ask you.
Yeah. Well, thank you for all these questions. Cause it's just, yeah, I honestly haven't really talked about, you know, these two sides of my life and how they come together, except with my husband, who, you know, I guess we talk about it a lot.
Yeah.
But it more, how are we going to make this work?
Yeah. Well, and I guess if you want to just elaborate on that a little more before we wrap up, like, I'm curious, you know, if your time to make your work and to put into your practice is just those kindergarten hours, or like, how do you guys kind of navigate, you know, when you're doing things that might take you out of town, or you have like, you need to work longer than that. Like, what does that look like for you?
Well, we have help. Like my husband's parents, I don't know how we could have survived without them. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, for us having family around, mm-hmm. my parents are older and they're not as available, you know, physically. Mm-hmm. But having, you know, his family, it was so important. And so, you know, like I said, when we first got here, Noah would be there on the weekends. And even now, if I have like, say Noah was sick and my husband has a day job, so he can't take off a day, I will cover those days of vacation or sick days. But then on a weekend, my husband will take him to the farm, and then I'll have the weekend to work.
Okay.
So we kind of have this balance of sometimes, you know, my husband and I, we don't really see each other that much because we're just trying to give each other creative time. So that's, you know, and I'm so grateful to have a partner that can share some of that, you know, the time, the care. And Noah's also been in pretty much full-time daycare since we moved to Nashville.
Okay.
So when I was at Vanderbilt, they have a daycare there. And, you know, sometimes we would feel guilty about having him from, you know, 8 o'clock to 5 p.m. at daycare every day since he was like 3 o'clock. But he does so much better at school than with us because at school, he's like a very, social, this wonderful, kind friend, ready to learn. And when he's around us, he knows he can just fall apart.
So, oh yeah. I say that to my friends all the time. I'm like, my kids are the worst around us
because,
you know,
they can be.
They're the safest. They're they know that this is when they can express what they need to express or it's hard as a parent though to you know, to hear people talk about your kid as like one way and you're like, "Real, my kid? My kid?"
We were so surprised that first parent-teacher conference. I mean, I honestly thought they were going to kick him out of school because they couldn't, you know, I was like, this kid is, he's wonderful when he's, when he's happy, but when he's upset, it's very intense. But as I'm learning, that's pretty normal, you know, again, it's like first time mom, only time mom. So So yes, we've had a lot of daycare help. So that gives us time and time is just everything. When we have it, we are like locked in. So I'm definitely not very social anymore. Once in a while, I'll go to an opening or go out to lunch with someone, but I'm pretty hermetic because I protect my time now.
What do you do for you, Emily? I'm curious if you spend any, like, do you take off Friday afternoons and you always go for a long walk or do you, have a reading practice or like what's self-care to Emily?
Oh my gosh. Well, I don't think I do enough of it, honestly. I think it's hard to separate being in the studio from, you know, that feels like the time to nurture because I was so starved of it for so long with like, you know, having obligations and then the years of being a, you know, early, like a young parent or a parent with a young kid. I do, like I read every night. I go to bed really early. So like people don't really ask me to go out at night anymore because they know I get in bed by 9 o'clock and I'm like reading a novel. Like I'm not reading, you know, I'm not reading any dense theoretical texts.
Right.
So yeah, if that's a practice, then that's what I do. I go to bed and I read before bed. But
absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean,
I wish there were more, or, you know, I'll spend time with my husband's parents who take my son and then I'll just like, you know, go out to lunch or something. It's like, there's, if my former self heard me saying this, I would never have had children. He'd be like, what are you? What have you become?
Yeah, but I think that also is a gift of parenthood is like, you know, just 5 minutes by yourself sometimes.
So wonderful.
Where you're not putting pressure on yourself to do anything. Just that gift of like appreciating presence, you know.
Exactly.
All right. Well, I always close with five final questions just for our listeners to get to know you a little bit better. No pressure on, you know, making these the best answers ever. I know they're hard questions. I want to know, who is your biggest art crush? It can be over your whole life or at the moment.
Okay. I guess over my whole life, it's always been Georgia O'Keeffe, like since I was a little girl, because that was my mom's. You know, she loved O'Keeffe and she had lived in the desert for a while. And recently it's like, I like Magritte. I think Magritte is really resonating with me these days.
Awesome. Okay. What is a favorite place that you like to travel or a dream trip that you'd like to go on?
Well, my favorite place is France because I'm like a fake French person. I just found out in my DNA, I'm 3% French.
Woohoo! So,
yeah, that's a win. I am French. But I think my dream trip would be like with the whole family would be to go to Japan. Because, you know, we all have our own reasons.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Tell me a film or a book that has been a big inspiration to you.
Okay. Yeah. The film is it's Children of Paradise. It's a 1945 film. It's set in like 1800s Paris. It's by Marcel Carnet. And it was filmed in occupied Vichy, France. So it was during the end of the Second World War.
Wow.
And it is like the most lush, incredible film. It has to do with, it's a black and white film about a theater where there's like Pierrot, like a mime character and a Harlequin character, and they're in love. It's like, you know, so archetypal,
yeah,
but so beautiful and poetic. And just knowing that this film was made at a time of like, you know, the apparently like the fruit that was on the table as a set, they were like injecting it with like resin so people wouldn't eat the fruit. You know, like people were so impoverished.
Yeah.
But they were making this piece of art that was like so transcendent and amazing. So that's my favorite film. I recommend it to everyone.
Children it's of like Paradise?
Children of Paradise. Yeah. Awesome. In French. It's in French with subtitles.
Okay. All right. Well, speaking of food, what is your favorite meal?
Okay. Yes. So like Japanese food for me, like very good Japanese food is my favorite. There's a place called Hibino in Brooklyn. And that's like, you know, my favorite. If I'm in New York, that's where I'm going to go. Okay.
And finally, who would you like to give a shout out to just thank for supporting your work? You know,
I think, you know, it's like, there's so many people, but like, you know, my grad school friends in New York and my husband and his family and my family, you know, it can't just be one. It's so many people.
Well, and your kid for making you leave New York and
Noah
have this great growth in your practice.
Yeah, always kicking my ass into a different place than I would have expected.
Emily, where can people find out more about you and your work? Are you on Instagram? What's your website?
Yes. Yeah. Instagram, I'm Emily Wiener. And my website's emilywiener.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Again, I feel like I have a million more questions. Maybe we'll have to do part two, but I appreciate
let's do it again.
Yeah. Appreciate your time, Emily.
Thank you so much. I feel like I have so much insight now.
Yeah.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.